been so many years since it happened, but I can still remember every second of it. It's like the memories have been soldered into my mind, and no matter how much I try to, I can never forget my time at the Tennessee Children's Home Society. I was just 9 years old when I was taken. I can't remember what my mother's face looked like, but I can remember her protest as they dragged me away. The year was 1946, and I had just been placed in an adoption agency in Memphis, Tennessee. While I can't remember what my mom looked like, I can still recall why they took me away from her. My mom was a single parent, so she had to overwork herself to feed the both of us. She usually left me alone for long periods of time due to her work, and she often came back late at night. I was an only child, so being alone most of the time made me very mature for my age. I had to learn to take care of myself, as I did many things around the house on my own. Most of our neighbors accosted my mother of neglecting her child, but even at that age, I knew she was doing what she had to do to put food on our table. While we didn't spend much time together, I loved my mother and I was grateful for everything that she was doing. Our life wasn't perfect, but it was fine and I loved being with her, but our time together didn't last as, unfortunately, things soon took a drastic turn. My mother had fallen terribly ill. She lost her job due to her health problems and things soon became much harder for the both of us. She still had some money that she saved up from work, so that was what she used to feed us during this time. Our neighbors, who heard about our situation, decided that my mother was unfit to take care of me, and the word soon spread to a nearby adoption agency in Memphis, and that's when they came for me. I can never forget the morning they arrived, and it was the first time I saw the executive secretary of the agency, Miss Tan. I hadn't even spoken to her yet, and I already knew that she was a cold woman. She and her colleagues basically ganged up on my mother and forced her to turn over my custody to them. My mother didn't agree at first, as she told them that she'd get better soon and she'd get back to work, but they told her there was no assurance of that. My mom did not want to let me go, and I didn't want to leave, but I was smart enough to know that we didn't have a choice. In a bid to convince my mother to let me go, they told her that I would only be temporarily placed in their care until she got better. So my mother begrudgingly agreed. Before we left, my mother asked if she could hug me and say goodbye, but they didn't allow her to as they dragged me out of our house. I can remember screaming and protesting when they didn't allow her to say goodbye. She screamed and said she'd changed her mind, but her pleas all fell on deaf ears as they forcefully took me away. I struggled, but there was nothing I could do. As they put me in the car, I could see the faces of our neighbors who they thought were doing the right thing by calling the adoption agency, but unbeknownst to them, they had just sent me to a place that was worse than hell itself. My time at the Tennessee Children's Home Society was the worst years of my life. For some unexplained reason, my temporary placement had now become a permanent one, as no one told me when I was going back home. There was little to no food at the children's home, so I was hungry most of the time. The all-female staff that was in charge of us wore white nursing outfits. These women were very abusive, and they treated us horribly. I remember an incident where I asked for a little extra portion of food, and I was punched across the face. The blow tore my lip, and I remember crying through the pain for days. Every day was worse than the last, and I prayed every night that I'd leave one day, but even then I knew that things weren't in my favor. The couples who came to the children's home looking to adopt often chose infants, and the older children, like me, were never picked or chosen as not many families were looking for older kids. Due to the lack of interest, the staff hated the older children at the home, and they often neglected us. This led most of us to band together and take care of ourselves, and that's how I met my friends, Katie and Natasha. Even though my days at the children's home were still horrible, my friends Katie and Natasha made things a little bit more bearable for me. We'd usually tell jokes, we'd laugh with each other, and we'd talk about our dreams and the places we'd go when we finally left the children's home. For a while, I managed to find a little bit of happiness with my friends, but things didn't stay like that, as during this time, I started to notice some very strange things that were going on in the children's home. For some unknown reason, most of the kids at the children's home started to disappear. It was like they vanished into thin air as no explanation was given for their disappearance. I knew they weren't being adopted, as the entire children's home usually knew when a child was adopted. It wasn't only the older kids, as some babies also went missing too. Most of the other kids didn't seem to notice or care about this, as it seemed like I was the only one who noticed the strange activity. My mother always told me that I was a very perceptive child, so I guess that's why it stood out to me. I was concerned and worried about the strange disappearances, but I didn't do anything or ask any questions, as I knew that would lead to a beating from the staff. But it wasn't long before Natasha mysteriously disappeared, and I knew I had to start asking questions now. I remember asking one of the nurses, an evil woman named Alice, what happened to Natasha. Alice had a scar on her cheek, and she always had a scorn on her face. Her eyes were bulging red, and she usually looked at children like we were the most disgusting things on the planet Earth. Everyone was terrified of her, but she was the only one who was on duty that afternoon. So I summoned up the courage, and I asked her if she knew what happened to Natasha. The first thing Alice did was slap me across the face as she screamed,
"You insolent demon child! How dare you speak to me directly? Don't you dare ask me stupid questions or speak that child's name in this home again."
And with that, she stormed off. The slap didn't hurt as much as it used to because, as messed up as it sounds, I had already gotten used to the constant abuse I was subjected to at the children's home. So I wasn't going to give up, and I kept on spying on Alice at any chance I could get, as I knew she'd eventually lead me to an answer. It took a couple of days, but one night, I saw Alice carrying something to an empty plot of land near the children's home. I couldn't really see what she was doing, but it looked like she put the package in a shallow hole that she dug in the ground before filling the hole with sand. I told myself that she must have been hiding something important there, so I made plans to sneak out of the children's home and check what it was that very night. The day was the 14th of May, 1948. I was just 11 years old at the time, and I had managed to sneak out of the children's home that night, and I made my way to the empty plot of land. It was dark, but I could tell where Alice had dug by the fresh dirt. I didn't have a shovel, so I had to use my hands. It hurt to dig with my bare hands, but I was determined. It wasn't long till I reached something, as the hole was pretty shallow, but what I saw horrified me to the core. Sticking out of the dirt was the hand of a child, and as I cleared away a little more sand, I saw the decaying face of my friend Natasha. There are a lot of things that can permanently scar an 11-year-old child, but this didn't just scar me, it destroyed my entire mental state. I could tell that Natasha wasn't the only one buried in the shallow grave, as I could see the remains of infants and some other children. I started to scream at the top of my lungs, and it wasn't long before Alice and the staff found me. They immediately dragged me back to the children's home, and they reported what I did to the head of the agency, Miss Tan. Both she and Alice then proceeded to beat me within an inch of my life, and they made sure that I swore never to repeat what I saw. I screamed for days till I lost my voice, and I kept screaming when I recovered it, as I couldn't get the horrific image out of my mind. Miss Tan and Alice would sedate me whenever I screamed, and they would sometimes lock me up and leave me to starve anytime they wanted to teach me a lesson. My only friend, Katie, would often sneak a small portion of her already little food to me, and I'm guessing that's what kept me alive. I still don't know how I survived the whole ordeal, and I can never forget Miss Tan's cold eyes after she locked me up and said,
"I would have killed you with my bare hands for what you did, but some of my clients have started showing interest in older children. That is the only reason you are alive, as your worthless life might go for a good price."
A couple of days passed after that before I was finally let out. I was told a couple wanted to adopt a female child between the years of 8 and 13, and I was chosen. I remember crying as I told them, "I don't want to be adopted. I want to go home to my mother." I was then told that my mother had died, so I couldn't go back to her, and this new family was my only option. It hurt me badly to hear that, and I cried profusely as they covered up my bruises and made me presentable for my new family. The last thing I remember from the Tennessee Children's Home Society was telling Katie goodbye and the satisfied look on Miss Tan's face as they drove me away to start my new life. Luckily for me, my adoptive parents, Frank and Lucille, were very kind. Frank was a wealthy businessman, and Lucille was a psychologist turned teacher. She and Frank could tell that I was traumatized, so they took care of me and gave me the help I needed. It took a while, but I eventually managed to heal. Shockingly, just 2 years after I had been adopted, I'd seen on the news that Miss Beulah George Tan was an American child trafficker who operated the Tennessee Children's Home Society, an adoption agency in Memphis, Tennessee. The reporter stated that most of the children were either forcefully taken from their families or kidnapped and sold to wealthy couples and families. It also stated that most of the children were abused during their time at the children's home, and in some morbid instances, some of them were murdered. About 5,000 estimated children were stolen, and about 19 officially recorded children were killed due to abuse. Some of Tan's victims were confirmed to be buried in Elmwood Cemetery in Memphis, Tennessee. However, a lot of other children were never accounted for. The exact number of deceased children remains unknown, as there was an estimate of about 500 deaths due to mistreatment. A state investigation that started on the 11th of September, 1950, due to the rising instances of adoption fraud and a black market baby adoption scheme that made $10 millions, led to the closure of Tennessee Children's Home in 1950. But Georgia Tan died of cancer 3 days before charges were placed, so she was never prosecuted. I was still a child when this all happened, so I didn't fully understand the situation. But I looked into everything when I grew older, and that's when I realized that Miss Tan ran the adoption agency like some sort of messed up baby bargain. I also found out that I was one of the lucky few to be put with a good family, as I heard some of the children were put with abusive families or used as child labor on farms. Looking into the incident brought back a lot of bad memories, but I was eventually able to move on from it. Once I was in my 20s, I looked for my birth mother, and I soon found out that the children's home had lied to me, as she'd only died about 3 years ago. I also found out that she looked for me with everything she had. While I love my adoptive parents, I still wish I could have given her that hug and told her how much I loved her. I am married now to a good man, and I have a daughter. Even after all these years, I know I can never forget my time at the Tennessee Children's Home Society. I read that the massive scandal surrounding the adoption agency caused adoption reform laws in Tennessee, and I was really glad, as I would never wish what I went through on my worst enemy. Sometimes I wonder what happened to my friend Katie. I hoped she was able to survive that dreadful place. I know that she's out there somewhere, and I wish she managed to get a happy ending like I did. The tale you just heard was a story I pulled from the pages of my mother, Miss Olivia Jones' diary. She's 86 years old now, and she was born in 1937, and she's still going strong. My mother always took me to the memorial for the Tennessee Children's Home Society victims in Elmwood Cemetery when I was a kid, and I never understood why until I read this story. I'm glad she was able to survive, so I decided to share her story to raise awareness on the horrific events that transpired in that adoption agency so many years ago, and to enlighten the current adoption agencies to put more care into their wards. Our children are the future, and we should take care of them as best we can.
Hello. My name is Brian. This is a story of how a little adoption trip could have gone terribly wrong and almost end my life. You might think that my girlfriend and I wanted to adopt a child, but we don't. We really aren't interested in having children, at least for now. What we did go to adopt was a little puppy. The trip was long, and both my girlfriend and I thought, well, since we're going to California to adopt a puppy, why not stay a few days and take a vacation? Once we went to adopt the dog, we met the owner at the shelter. The girl seemed a little reclusive, but you could tell she was a good person. She not only gave us the dog and all the papers to make the adoption official, but she also recommended a hotel to spend a few days near the beach. The puppy was beautiful. He was a small black dog with two different colored eyes. He was still about 5 months old, but since his legs were quite long, we could tell he was going to be a big dog. I really didn't want to stress him too much traveling back and forth, so we just went to the hotel the girl recommended, and luckily we got a room and were able to settle in. The hotel was very nice. We were close to the beach and had all the amenities for a vacation. I really thought that with the dog, we wouldn't be able to go anywhere, but it actually made things easier. The dog was already vaccinated and could go for a walk, so it wouldn't be a problem. What was going to be a problem were the neighbors. You see, we rented the hotel for 2 weeks, which was what we had left on our vacation. But on the second day of the hotel, we started to receive a lot of complaints from the management. These complaints said that our dog was too noisy, that he barked, and that he didn't let them sleep. Apart from being cruel and unfair, this was a lie, since the puppy hardly made any noise and barked only once or twice during the whole day. We tried to be out of the hotel as much of the time as possible. We rested the puppy to sleep when we got to the hotel, and mostly it worked. The dog was very calm and quiet, but the complaints not only kept coming, they got worse. They were getting more and more aggressive, and it got to the point that the hotel staff told us that if the complaints kept coming, we had to leave. At this point, we didn't know what to do. We really didn't want to go to another hotel, and the fact that they were kicking us out seemed really unfair. Whoever was complaining must really hate dogs. The night we were about to spend our first week there, we started to hear a lot of noises upstairs. Someone was moving a lot of furniture. It was 4 a.m. This really wasn't the time to remodel. Startled by the noises, the puppy started barking in fright. In response, the furniture stopped moving, but we heard something else. The person who was moving the furniture started banging on the floor, which reached our ceiling. At the same time, he also shouted something.
Shut that damn dog up before he gets you thrown out!
That was it. This was the person who was denouncing us. Furious, I went upstairs to have a chat. My girlfriend wanted to come with me, but someone had to keep an eye on the dog. Besides, she knew where I was going to be. Once I climbed the stairs, it wasn't hard to find the room where the complaints were coming from. The door was open, and inside, it was dark. I thought about leaving. Something about that place gave me a bad feeling. But suddenly, the lady who had threatened us before started screaming. They were not screams of rage, they were screams of pain. Something was happening to her. No matter how angry I was with her, I could not allow a woman to be hurt, whether it was a thief or her own husband. I went in determined to see what was happening. To my surprise, the door closed, and I was left in the dark. There was no more screaming, no more movement, no more complaining, nothing. It was as if the room was empty. The light came on almost instantly, but something was wrong. The light was red. Upon inspecting the hotel room, it had no furniture, and there were satanic symbols drawn all over the room. In the center, there was a huge pentagram. Without time to process what was happening, I felt someone grab me from behind and hold a knife to my throat, making a sound as if to make me understand that I had to be quiet. From the leftovers, a woman in a ceremonial robe walked into the circle. Once she took off her robe, I recognized her. It was the woman from the shelter, the woman who gave us the puppy for adoption. The woman walked towards me with a somber, indifferent look on her face. She had a syringe in her hand, and without giving me time to speak, she quickly injected me. My body began to feel weak. I didn't lose consciousness. I didn't fall asleep or hallucinate, but my body became very weak, and I collapsed. The man began to drag me to the center of the circle, and once I was there, they took off all my clothes, leaving me in my underwear. The woman from the shelter approached me with a huge dagger that she pointed at the center of my chest. Suddenly, someone banged violently on the door to the room. It was my girlfriend for sure. I had to warn her not to come in. I had to tell her that she was in danger. Everyone waved to the other, and they turned the lights off. One man hid behind the door as he did with me. He opened it slowly. I tried to scream, to move, to make noise, but I couldn't. My body was totally paralyzed. When the door finished opening, my girlfriend was behind it with the dog in her hands, but she was not alone. The hotel manager and two policemen who were guarding the place were with her. The policeman pulled out his gun and quickly pointed it at the man behind the door. The lights came on and the other two people in the house raised their hands. I was safe. After I was rescued, I learned the whole truth. The neighbors' complaints were not real. This was all a trap by the girl at the shelter to get me to go into that apartment of my own free will. She recommended this hotel to me because that's where her boyfriend worked. Her boyfriend was the morning shift manager, the man who made up all the claims. My girlfriend found out that something was wrong with me because, without my knowledge, she followed me from afar to see that everything was in order and saw how someone who was hiding locked me in the room. When she went to tell the manager, he not only told her that he knew nothing about the complaints, he told her that the room had not been rented for over a month. This whole pet adoption thing was a front. A front to get young couples to be victims of their sacrifices and rituals they were trying to do in that apartment. I was not the first victim, as there were people before me who were not as lucky as I was. Luckily, the dog was still with us, but in our home. From that day on, I could never again go to a hotel without being scared, ignoring every sound we heard, and locking the doors immediately.
My name is Cameron John, and for some time in my life, I lived shortly with a foster family, as both my parents had passed away when I was 9 years old. My mom died from diabetes, and my dad died from a heart attack not long after. Understandably, the years that followed that incident were horrible for me, but to this day, no experience has been as horrifying as the Bishop's foster family. It all started shortly after my father passed. I was a 9-year-old only child with almost no immediate relatives, so it didn't take long for child services to arrive and take me away. I was informed there was nothing to be worried about as they already had a foster family assigned to me. The ward also informed me that my new foster family was well known and had previously taken care of up to 13 kids in the past, and the government trusted them completely with the safety of kids like me. The next day, I was put in a car with my ward and taken to my new home. As we arrived, the first thing I noticed was the home was in a very remote area. A large house stood alone surrounded by a massive field, and the whole thing was surrounded by a fence. It was a beautiful sight, if I'm being honest, but at the time, nothing could really make me happy. We drove past the gate and towards the house where a group of people stood waiting. Out the window, I noticed an extra person mowing the field. He should have been around 6'7", but his clothes hinted he wasn't a part of the family, so I simply looked away. I stepped down from the car and realized the group was made up of 9 people. The father was dressed in a black and white priest gown, and the mother, something similar with a scarf on her head. The 7 kids behind them varied in ethnicity and age, but I could tell just by looking that amongst them, I would be the youngest. The mother immediately walked up to me and gave me a tight hug. She pulled away saying, "Hello, Cameron. We know it's been a hard few days, but you'll be fine. Welcome to the Bishop family." The days after that were completely normal. I was introduced to the kids and discovered I was right in assuming I'd be the youngest, as the one closest to me was a 12-year-old girl named Angela. Ironically, it turned out Mr. Bishop was an actual priest, and for the little time I'd spent at the house, I'd never seen him in anything other than his black and white gown. The large man I saw mowing the lawn was in the house regularly and seemed to be part of the family. Everyone called him Uncle Sam, and when he wasn't mowing, he'd be fixing something or talking with the adults. I spent most of my time outside in the fields reading, as the kids weren't allowed to go to school. Instead, we were homeschooled by mother and spent most of the day doing nothing. "Guys, aren't you sometimes bored staying home all day?" It took some time, but eventually, Angela responded, "Father and mother say we aren't ready yet." She continued with, "They say if we go outside, the demons will come for us, and nobody wants that." I was confused, as I figured we'd all been outside at least once in the past before coming here, but that's when the oldest child, Arthur, spoke.
"Besides, I don't know about you, but we're happy here. There's no purpose for people like us out there. Here's safe and the outside isn't. There's way too many sinners out there, and quite simply, it's disgusting." He paused and held contact before saying,
"Also, the demons that took our parents are still out there. We need to be complete or they'll take us too."
I didn't know what it was at that time, but after that conversation, I never felt right being with the other kids. I simply cried that night and went to bed. I woke up later that night to use the toilet, and I could tell it was really late at night, but as I walked towards the bathroom, I began hearing muffled noises. I couldn't tell where they were coming from, but after noticing them, I couldn't stop noticing. I decided it was probably nothing, simply got back in bed and chose to ignore the noises that night. The next morning, I couldn't stop thinking about those noises I heard the previous night, so I decided to ask mother and father. I woke up last night to pee, and I heard a couple of weird noises. Do you guys know what they were?" Father kept his usual expressionless face and simply looked away, but mother looked at me and replied,
"Now, Cameron, you shouldn't have been awake so late at night. That's when the demons come out. You're simply not yet complete, so it's not safe. But don't worry, we'll take care of you till you're ready."
She plastered a smile on her face and left. Every night after that, I woke up around the same time to hear the same noises I heard that night. A part of me was curious, but I was mostly scared by what mother had said, so I would always force myself back to sleep. That was until that horrible night. I had been living with the bishops for 3 months now, and for almost 2 whole months, I had been hearing the same muffled noises every night from somewhere in the house. So I decided it was time to finally check it out. I woke up at the same time I always did, and sure enough, I could hear the muffled noises. Although I wasn't close to any, my plan was simply to get one of the other kids to come look with me. I walked into Arthur's room first, but his bed was completely empty. I figured he probably had to use the bathroom, so decided to get someone else, but shockingly, all 7 rooms were identical, with all 7 beds being completely empty. My naive mind immediately began to think back to what mother had told me about the demons, and it didn't take long for my palms to start sweating and my stomach to drop. I began to think the demons had taken everyone else and I was next, so completely scared, I headed for the parents' room. I had never gone in there before, but my fear wasn't letting me think clearly, so I walked right in without knocking and shut the door. It took a while for me to catch my breath, but when I did, I turned to see a large bed that stood in an odd position, almost like it had been moved, and just like the other rooms, no one was in it. It was only at this point I noticed the muffled noises seemed louder and were obviously coming from this room. More importantly, they weren't muffled, and I could now tell without a doubt that they were in fact voices. I slowly approached the bed, and sure enough, it had been moved to reveal a wooden staircase that led to the voices I had been hearing. I couldn't tell what was happening from where I was standing, but for some reason, I was scared, as I didn't know what I would see, but I knew for a fact it wasn't something I was meant to see. Against my better judgment, I slowly walked down the staircase until I could see. My heart dropped immediately. I saw what was going on. The bishop family, all dressed in father's black and white gown, they stood in a circle, and in the middle was a middle-aged man in his underwear. The man was knelt down with both hands chained to the walls. His body had marks all over, and his mouth was gagged shut. It also looked like his head had been shaved, and there were pieces of leftover hair on his head. The family was constantly chanting the words, "To purge the sinner, to purge the sinner, to purge the sinner." But eventually, Father walked towards the man and signaled for silence. He then proceeded to say,
"Family, we are gathered here once more because evil never rests. That is why we will never rest."
He paused to collect a knife from Arthur before continuing with,
"Bishops, what is our purpose?"
They all responded once more with the words,
"To purge the sinner."
At this point, I was completely gripped by fear, but I had just realized the family was crazy, knew I had to get out of the house quickly. But as I turned to leave, the stairs led out a large creak, and immediately the family turned to see me.
"Cameron, I told you not to be up by this time. We haven't even started your lessons yet."
Mother looked at me more disappointed than shocked, and none of the family members even seemed to care about the fact I, a 9-year-old child, had seen what they were doing. That's when Father said,
"It's fine, Madeline. Come, Cameron."
He gestured for me to walk towards him. I slowly walked back down to him, and he placed a hand around my shoulder before facing me towards the chained-up man, saying,
"The lessons on humanity we teach you are
just that
lesson. What makes you a truly complete human is moments like these. The man before you is a sinner."
His scream startled me, and I began to cry.
"Sin is the reason God punishes us, why he's taken all your families. Sinners are the reason you are alone in this world. Now, will you allow more pain and suffering, Cameron? It's your duty to prevent that. So hear."
At this point, he forced the knife into my hand and pushed me closer to the man.
"Cut his throat, Cameron, and become complete. You are no longer alone. You are now a bishop. And what is the duty of a bishop?"
The room replied,
"To purge the sinner."
I was shaking now, and I could tell the man in front of me was just as scared as I was. I continued to cry as he held my shoulders and repeated the words,
"Purge the sinner."
Eventually, I was able to gather my thoughts, and as Father repeated those words, I took the knife and stabbed it in his leg. He instantly let out a screeching sound, and I immediately ran up the stairs and out of the room. I didn't stop running, and it wasn't long till I was out the door and headed for the gate. But I soon heard footsteps behind me and turned to see the looming figure of Uncle Sam charging towards me. He wasn't close initially, but every time I turned, he seemed closer and closer. I could now see the gate and what seemed like headlights coming towards it. And at that moment, all I could do was hope I got there before Uncle Sam got to me. I ran out the gate and fell hard on the road. The car headed my way abruptly stopped, and seated in the driver's seat was an elderly lady.
"Is everything all right, young man?"
she said, looking out the window. I quickly ran to the other side, crying, and said,
"Please help me, ma'am. Please. They're trying to kill me."
The initial confusion was written all over the woman's face, but she simply opened the door and I quickly got in. As we drove off, I looked out the corner of my eye to see Uncle Sam standing by the open gate, staring furiously at me, and in the distance, the silhouette of who I assumed was Father staring out of a window from the house. Soon enough, the house was out of sight, and that would be the last time I would ever see the Bishop household. In the weeks that followed, I explained the situation to my ward and the officers in charge of the case. At first, they all thought I was an orphan acting out, but that view completely changed after they visited the home and found no trace of the Bishop family. Blood samples were found in the hidden basement I described, but most samples appeared to have a mixture of different people's DNA and proved inconclusively. In the end, only a few victims were identified. The fact I claimed to hear those noises every night for almost 2 months led authorities to believe the Bishop family had taken up to an estimated 200 lives in the past few years. The government ended up putting me in an orphanage for the next 9 years of my life, and as expected, I received regular therapy and counseling during my time in the orphanage. The truth is, anyone who hasn't been a foster kid can't truly understand the courage it takes to live with a complete group of strangers. The ideals, beliefs, and culture of these strangers may not be what we think they are. Some people get loving homes while others end up in the worst places imaginable, disguised as loving homes. I, on the other hand, was stuck in hell during my time in foster care, and I hope no one ever experiences what it's like to be a part of the Bishop Foster Care family.